The Novels of Charles Dickens, An Introduction, written by David Timpson, and read by Neville Jason. Dombey and Son. In his preface to the 1867 edition of Dombey and Son, Dickens wrote, "I began this book by the Lake of Geneva, and went on with it for some months in France before pursuing it in England." It was a strange book to write on a family holiday, dealing as it does essentially with a dysfunctional family, the Dombeys, particularly the estrangement between Mr. Dombey and his young daughter Florence. Begun in 1846, Dombey and Son is the first of Dickens's novels for which his working notes have survived, and they clearly show that he worked out the shape of his novels in detail beforehand. His central theme was to be pride and its effects on a family. Mr. Dombey epitomizes this pride. He has pride in himself, his achievements, and his unchallenged position in the material world of commerce. However, it is an arid world, a prison of his own making that shuts out his daughter Florence from any emotional contact, because she is considered of no use to his all-important business because she is a girl. Dombey, in contrast, overburdens his little son Paul with expectations that the child could never sustain. Mr. Dombey is incapable of feeling love and affection for his family, his natural emotions warped by the pursuit of material success. Mr. Dombey has to be dismantled piece by piece throughout the novel, and reconstructed as a loving father and a man of feeling through the power of forgiveness. This is Dickens's main narrative. Dickens contrasts the unnatural, the pursuit of power and wealth, with the natural, the love of family and friends, showing the constant struggle between the two that exists in every human being and the society they create. Florence is a study in emotional deprivation and depression. She bursts into tears 88 times. She takes upon herself the blame for her father's indifference towards her. Her confusion leads her to believe that love is something that can be learnt, and painfully observes its effects in other families, seeking the key to affection, but never finding it. Such analysis gives a darker and more sombre mood to the novel than anything Dickens had written so far. It was a difficult book to write, and at times a melancholy experience for Dickens. He was always deeply moved by the death scenes he created, but such writing fortified Dickens' reputation with the public as a master of pathos, which was an important aspect to him of his relationship with his readers. Dombey and Son, published in book form in 1848, was the first novel to include passages dealing with the newly developing railway. Dickens uses it to symbolize the ruthless mechanical drive of progress and business, Dombey's world, unfeeling and unstoppable. Dickens saw the railway as an unnatural development on the one hand, destroying communities and bringing speed and danger into our daily lives, but also he could see this was the face of progress, and perhaps a necessary evil. Dickens always had an ambivalent attitude to the railway, seeming to fear it, a premonition that was to come true when he was injured in a railway accident at Staplehurst in 1865. Dickens describes Dombey as a man of ice. By contrast, he uses water as an image of a flexible, shifting flow of emotion, epitomized in one of his happiest creations, the old sea salt Captain Cuttle. "Glorious Captain Cuttle," wrote Forster, "laying his head to the wind and fighting through everything." He is a comic character, but presented as a fully rounded individual, and indeed Dickens integrates all his comic characters more successfully into the plot in this novel than he had heretofore. He surrounds the Dombeys with a set of thoroughly dysfunctional characters, disconnected now from their former place in society. Major Bagstock, is used to being obeyed, but out of the army is out of step with the world. Miss Tox clings to the time when she had position, but is now a symbol of faded gentility. Likewise, Mrs. Skewton, once the toast of fashionable society, her beauty gone, presents a pathetic picture. They all have an important part to play in illustrating the book's theme of natural versus unnatural, whilst not failing to entertain the reader. With the novel finished, Dickens regained his usual high spirits, which were supported by the successful sales figures for the monthly parts which were eagerly snapped up as they appeared. With this novel, it can be said that Dickens came of age as a writer. "There's no writing against such power as this," Thackeray wrote of Dombey. "It is stupendous."
Florence and her father.
Mr. Dombey rang the bell and walked till it was answered. "Tell them always to let Miss Florence be with Richards when she chooses, and go out with her, and so forth. Tell them to let the children be together when Richards wishes it." The iron was now hot, and Richards, striking on it boldly — it was a good cause, and she was bold in it, though instinctively afraid of Mr. Dombey — requested that Miss Florence might be sent down then and there, to make friends with her little brother. She feigned to be dandling the child as the servant retired on this errand, but she thought she saw that Mr. Dombey's colour changed, that the expression of his face quite altered, that he turned hurriedly, as if to gainsay what he had said, or she had said, or both, and was only deterred by very shame. And she was right. The last time he had seen his slighted child, there had been that in the sad embrace between her and her dying mother, which was at once a revelation and a reproach to him. Let him be absorbed as he would in the son on whom he built such high hopes, he could not forget that closing scene. He could not forget that he had had no part in it, that at the bottom of its clear depths of tenderness and truth lay those two figures clasped in each other's arms, while he stood on the bank above them, looking down, a mere spectator, not a sharer with them, quite shut out. Unable to exclude these things from his remembrance, or to keep his mind free from such imperfect shapes of the meaning with which they were fraught, as were able to make themselves visible to him through the mist of his pride, his previous feeling of indifference towards little Florence changed into an uneasiness of an extraordinary kind. He almost felt as if she watched and distrusted him, as if she held the clue to something secret in his breast, of the nature of which he was hardly informed himself, as if she had an innate knowledge of one jarring and discordant string within him, and her very breath could sound it. His feeling about the child had been negative from her birth. He had never conceived an aversion to her. It had not been worth his while or in his humour. She had never been a positively disagreeable object to him, but now he was ill at ease about her. She troubled his peace. He would have preferred to put her idea aside altogether, if he had known how. Perhaps, who shall decide on such mysteries, he was afraid that he might come to hate her. When little Florence timidly presented herself, Mr. Dombey stopped in his pacing up and down and looked towards her. Had he looked with greater interest and with a father's eye, he might have read in her keen glance the impulses and fears that made her waver, the passionate desire to run clinging to him, crying, as she hid her face in his embrace, "Oh, Father, try to love me! There's no one else!" The dread of a repulse, the fear of being too bold and of offending him, the pitiable need in which she stood of some assurance and encouragement, and how her overcharged young heart was wandering to find some natural resting place for its sorrow and affection. But he saw nothing of this. He saw her pause irresolutely at the door and look towards him, and he saw no more. "Come in," he said. "Come in. What is the child afraid of?" She came in, and after glancing round her for a moment with an uncertain air, stood pressing her small hands hard together close within the door. "Come here, Florence," said her father coldly. "Do you know who I am?"
"Yes, Papa."
"Have you nothing to say to me?" The tears that stood in her eyes as she raised them quickly to his face were frozen by the expression it wore. She looked down again and put out her trembling hand. Mr. Dombey took it loosely in his own and stood looking down upon her for a moment as if he knew as little as the child what to say or do. "There. Be a good girl," he said, patting her on the head and regarding her, as it were by stealth, with a disturbed and doubtful look. "Go to Richard's. Go." His little daughter hesitated for another instant, as though she would have clung about him still, or had some lingering hope that he might raise her in his arms and kiss her. She looked up in his face once more. He thought how like her expression was then to what it had been when she looked round at the doctor that night, and instinctively dropped her hand and turned away.
Meeting Solomon Gills.
It is 5:30, and an autumn afternoon, when the reader and Solomon Gills become acquainted. Solomon Gills is in the act of seeing what time it is by the unimpeachable chronometer. The usual daily clearance has been making in the city for an hour or more, and the human tide is still rolling westward. "The streets have thinned," as Mr. Gills says, "very much. It threatens to be wet tonight. All the weather glasses in the shop are in low spirits, and the rain already shines upon the cocked hat of the wooden midshipman." "Where's Walter, I wonder?" said Solomon Gills, after he had carefully put up the chronometer again. "Here's dinner been ready 30 minutes, and no Walter!" Turning round upon his stool behind the counter, Mr. Gills looked out among the instruments in the window to see if his nephew might be crossing the road. No, he was not among the bobbing umbrellas, and he certainly was not the newspaper boy in the oilskin cap who was slowly working his way along the piece of brass outside, writing his name over Mr. Gills's name with his forefinger. "If I didn't know he was too fond of me to make a run of it, and go and enter himself aboard ship against my wishes, I should begin to be fidgety," said Mr. Gills, tapping two or three weather glasses with his knuckles. "I really should. All in the Downs, eh? Lots of moisture. Well, it's wanted." "I believe," said Mr. Gills, blowing the dust off the glass top of a compass case, "that you don't point more direct and due to the back parlour than the boy's inclination does, after all. And the parlour couldn't bear straighter, either. Due north, not the 20th part of a point either way."
"Hello, Uncle Sol."
"Hello, my boy," cried the instrument-maker, turning briskly round. "What, you are here, are you?" A cheerful-looking merry boy, fresh with running home in the rain, fair-faced, bright-eyed, and curly-haired.
"Well, Uncle, how have you got on without me all day? Is dinner ready? I'm so hungry."
"As to getting on," said Solomon good-naturedly, "it would be odd if I couldn't get on without a young dog like you a great deal better than with you. As to dinner being ready, it's been ready this 30 minutes and waiting for you. As to being hungry, I am."
"Come along then, Uncle," cried the boy.
"Hurrah for the Admiral!" "Confound the Admiral," returned Solomon Gills. "You mean the Lord Mayor."
"No, I don't," cried the boy.
"Hurrah for the Admiral! Hurrah for the Admiral! Forward!" At this word of command, the Welsh wig and its wearer were borne without resistance into the back parlour, as at the head of a boarding party of 500 men, and Uncle Sol and his nephew were speedily engaged on a fried sole with a prospect of steak to follow.
Mr. Dombey's Railway Journey.
away, with a shriek and a roar and a rattle from the town, burrowing among the dwellings of men and making the streets hum, flashing out into the meadows for a moment, mining in through the damp earth, booming on in darkness and heavy air, bursting out again into the sunny day so bright and wide. Away, with a shriek and a roar and a rattle, through the fields, through the woods, through the corn, through the hay, through the chalk, through the mould, through the clay, through the rock, among objects close at hand, and almost in the grasp, ever flying from the traveller, and a deceitful distance ever moving slowly with him, like as in the track of the remorseless monster, death. Through the hollow, on the height, by the heath, by the orchard, by the park, by the garden, over the canal, across the river, where the sheep are feeding, where the mill is going, where the barge is floating, where the dead are lying, where the factory is smoking, where the stream is running, where the village clusters, where the great cathedral rises, where the bleak moor lies, and the wild breeze smooths or ruffles it at its inconstant will. Away, with a shriek and a roar and a rattle, and no trace to leave behind but dust and vapour, like as in the track of the remorseless monster, death. Breasting the wind and light, the shower and sunshine, away and still away, it rolls and roars, fierce and rapid, smooth and certain, and great works and massive bridges crossing up above fall like a beam of shadow an inch broad upon the eye, and then are lost. Away and still away, onward and onward ever, glimpses of cottage homes, of houses, mansions, rich estates, of husbandry and handicraft, of people, of old roads and paths that look deserted, small and insignificant as they are left behind. And so they do. And what else is there but such glimpses in the track of the indomitable monster, death? Away, with a shriek and a roar and a rattle, plunging down into the earth again, and working on in such a storm of energy and perseverance that amidst the darkness and whirlwind the motion seems reversed, and to tend furiously backward, until a ray of light upon the wet wall shows its surface flying past like a fierce stream. Away once more into the day. And through the day, with a shrill yell of exultation, roaring, rattling, tearing on, spurning everything with its dark breath, sometimes pausing for a minute where a crowd of faces are that in a minute more are not, sometimes lapping water greedily, and before the spout at which it drinks has ceased to drip upon the ground, shrieking, roaring, rattling through the purple distance. Louder and louder yet it shrieks and cries as it comes tearing on resistless to the goal, and now its way, still like the way of death, is strewn with ashes thickly. Everything around is blackened. There are dark pools of water, muddy lanes and miserable habitations far below. There are jagged walls and falling houses close at hand, and through the battered roofs and broken windows, wretched rooms are seen, where want and fever hide themselves in many wretched shapes, while smoke and crowded gables and distorted chimneys and deformity of brick and mortar penning up, deformity of mind and body, choke the murky distance. As Mr. Dombey looks out of his carriage window, it is never in his thoughts that the monster who has brought him there has let the light of day in on these things, not made or caused them. It was the journey's fitting end, and might have been the end of everything. It was so ruinous and dreary.
Cleopatra.
In this manner, the Major and Mr. Dombey were walking arm in arm, much to their own satisfaction, when they beheld, advancing towards them, a wheeled chair, in which a lady was seated, indolently steering her carriage by a kind of rudder in front, while it was propelled by some unseen power in the rear. Although the lady was not young, she was very blooming in the face, quite rosy, and her dress and attitude were perfectly juvenile. Walking by the side of the chair, and carrying her gossamer parasol with a proud and weary air, as if so great an effort must be soon abandoned and the parasol dropped, sauntered a much younger lady, very handsome, very haughty, very wilful, who tossed her head and drooped her eyelids, as though, if there were anything in all the world worth looking into, save a mirror, It certainly was not the earth or sky.
"Why, what the devil have we here, sir?" cried the Major, stopping as this little cavalcade drew near.
"My dearest Edith," drawled the lady in the chair, "Major Bagstock."
The Major no sooner heard the voice than he relinquished Mr. Dombey's arm, darted forward, took the hand of the lady in the chair, and pressed it to his lips. With no less gallantry, the Major folded both his gloves upon his heart and bowed low to the other lady. And now, the chair having stopped, the motive power became visible in the shape of a flushed page pushing behind, who seemed to have in part outgrown and in part outpushed his strength. For when he stood upright, he was tall and wan and thin, and his plight appeared the more forlorn from his having injured the shape of his hat by butting at the carriage with his head to urge it forward, as is sometimes done by elephants in Oriental countries.
"Joe Bagstock," said the Major to both ladies, "is a proud and happy man for the rest of his life."
"You false creature," said the old lady in the chair insipidly. "Where do you come from? I can't bear you."
"Then suffer old Joe to present a friend, ma'am," said the Major promptly, "as a reason for being tolerated. Mr. Dombey, Mrs. Skewton."
The lady in the chair was gracious.
"Mr. Dombey, Mrs. Granger."
The lady with the parasol was faintly conscious of Mr. Dombey's taking off his hat and bowing low.
"I am delighted, sir," said the Major, "to have this opportunity."
The Major seemed in earnest, for he looked at all the three and leered in his ugliest manner.
"Mrs. Skewton, Dombey," said the Major, "makes havoc in the heart of old Josh."
Mr. Dombey signified that he didn't wonder at it.
"You perfidious goblin," said the lady in the chair, "have done. How long have you been here, bad man?"
"One day," replied the Major.
"And can you be a day, or even a minute?" returned the lady, slightly settling her false curls and false eyebrows with her fan,
and showing her false teeth set off by her false complexion.
"In the garden of, what's its name?"
"Eden, I suppose, mamma," interrupted the younger lady scornfully.
"My dear Edith," said the other, "I cannot help it. I never can remember those frightful names without having your whole soul and being inspired by the sight of nature. By the perfume," said Mrs. Skewton, rustling a handkerchief that was faint and sickly with essences, "of her artless breath, you creature!"
The discrepancy between Mrs. Skewton's fresh enthusiasm of words and forlornly faded manner was hardly less observable than that between her age, which was about 70, and her dress, which would have been youthful for 27. Her attitude in the wheeled chair, which she never varied, was one in which she had been taken in a barouche some 50 years before by a then fashionable artist who had appended to his published sketch the name of Cleopatra, in consequence of a discovery made by the critics of the time that it bore an exact resemblance to that princess as she reclined on board her galley. Mrs. Skewton was a beauty then, and bucks threw wine-glasses over their heads by dozens in her honour. The beauty and the barouche had both passed away. But she still preserved the attitude, and for this reason expressly maintained the wheeled chair and the butting page, there being nothing whatever except the attitude to prevent her from walking.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of Dombey and Son, read by David Timpson for Naxos Audiobooks.